I think we're ready to kick off today's session. Today's speaker is Bruce Vander. He's the TMDL coordinator in the Office of Ecosystem Protection and Remediation at the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency in Region 8. Bruce leads the TMDL team in EPA's Region 8 office in Denver, Colorado. He's been involved in various aspects of the TMDL program at EPA for 25 years. His experience includes developing TMDLs, assisting states and tribes in their TMDL programs, and providing training and presentations to a wide range of state, local, tribal, and private interests in the field of TMDL development and implementation. Bruce has served as an expert witness for EPA in TMDL lawsuits across the country. He's been involved in the development of agency policy and guidance related to the TMDL program. Before coming to EPA, Bruce worked for a private consulting engineering firms in the West and for the U.S. Department of Agriculture Soil Conservation Service. Good afternoon, Bruce.
Good afternoon, Susan. Can you hear me okay?
Yes, I can.
Great. Terrific. Thank you a lot for that introduction. I appreciate the opportunity to be on the webcast today, talking about one of my favorite topics, total maximum daily loads, TMDLs. Today we begin the presentation at slide number one with something old, a woodcut by Albrecht Dürer, the artist Dürer. I don't want to indicate that the TMDL dates back to the 15th century like this woodcut does, but it is pretty old in some respects. In one respect, Congress first established the TMDL program into law back in 1972. But on the other hand, it's a fairly new program because it's risen to its current notoriety just within the last 10 years. As we go to slide number two, we'll see the agenda for today's presentation. I'd like to review the parts and pieces of the TMDL program. Let's get familiar with those. We'd like to understand some of the terminology that comes along with the program. We'll view some case examples, and we'll understand how TMDLs can be your friend in the water quality business. Now, I want to address this because, as we see in slide three, even young babies sometimes freak out when you mention the term TMDL. I'm not sure why, but some people are fairly uneasy about the topic of TMDL. So let's take a look at this animal that we call the TMDL program and see how it can benefit our watershed processes. In slide four, we'll see a picture of a stream there. This reminds us of the goal of the Clean Water Act, which is to restore and protect the chemical, biological, and physical integrity of the nation's waters. TMDLs fit into this plan to achieve this goal. So let's look at the challenges behind this particular goal. First of all, no two waters are the same. As we see in slide four, a stream that is in the foothills of Colorado, but then if you go to slide five, there are plenty of streams that go through urban and developed areas. Slide six gives us a nice picture of a wetland, all different types of water bodies. In slide seven, this reminds us of the many uses that rely on those various water bodies. Aquatic life, recreation. In slide 8, reminds us of the agricultural use. Slide 9 also reminds us of the importance of water quality when it comes to agriculture. As we go to slide 10, this reminds us of the different faces of pollution, as we see in many of these water bodies that we're trying to protect. In slide 10, we'll see that many of the problems are related to water chemistry. In this case, slide 10 gives us a picture of a slide that is impacted by mining. In slide 11, we see not only a water body that's impaired by water chemistry, but also to other things such as habitat and sediment. In slide 12, we also are faced with the various ways that pollutants are introduced or discharged into surface waters. This varies also. In slide 12, we'll see a picture of a point source discharge coming into surface water. In slide 13, we're reminded of all the pollutants that can come into surface waters through stormwater also. Another picture of a point source discharge. And when I say point source discharge, I'm talking about a discharge of pollutants that come into surface waters through a discrete conveyance, a pipe or a ditch. In slide 14, some of the sites that we have to deal with in the TMDL world are fairly complex. This is a slide of a fairly complex mining site that involves groundwater, surface water, runoff during storm events, as well as a continuous discharge. In slide 15, some of the mine sites that we deal with in our region, at least, no one is at home. In particular, this is a picture of an abandoned mining site. Again, it could be a source of pollutants that we have to deal with in some sort of way. Slide 16 reminds us that activities in a watershed are seldom static, that so many things can be changing within a watershed. In this slide, it reminds us of the growth pressures that we see in many watersheds. The TMDL program then attempts to try to stay ahead or anticipate a growth within the watershed. Slide 17 presents yet a different situation here. This is a slide of a stream that is impaired due to sediment. Sometimes the cause of the problem is pretty obvious. In this particular watershed, the sediment problems were due not only to near, what I would call near field issues like eroding banks, but also we have to go way up into the watershed to see what the land uses are, because there may be something that is happening miles away from the impaired water body that is causing problems in the impaired water body itself. Having to do perhaps with land use in the uplands, anyway, causes us or requires us to take a broad view of the watershed in many cases. Slide 18 also reminds us of a very contemporary issue in the TMDL program, and that is dealing with pollutants that come into waterways through atmospheric deposition or air deposition, which can come at us from a lot of different angles, even outside the watershed. Sometimes we have to look at the full airshed to see where pollutants may be coming. In slide 19, we see a picture of, actually it's a freeway constructed through the mountains of Colorado here. This is the old way that we used to construct freeways, where there was quite a bit of land and slope that was exposed. And the result of this construction was the impairment of a stream downhill from here, where there was just loads of sediment coming into the stream and impairing the stream for aquatic life and for recreation also. But this slide in 19, which is an artifact of man's influence, contrasts with the slide number 20. They look similar, but actually number 20 is a picture of a natural formation, similar type of slope, similar type of exposure, and below this slope, this natural outcropping, we also see similar problems with sediment and actually metals too. So part of the challenge in the TMDL world is to discern how much of the particular pollutant load we're dealing with comes to us naturally, and how much of it is really anthropogenic in nature. So to sort that out can be a real challenge. In slide 21, we see a fairly nice scene of recreation here on a lake. But in slide 22, that same lake is seen during drought conditions. In slide 23, yet further drought conditions can be a challenge for the TMDL program. One of the things the TMDL program tries to do is identify what are some of the critical conditions under which we try to still maintain and attain our water quality goals. In slide 24, sometimes we see flow in the stream. And in slide 25, it could be gone, either because of drought, but in this case it was because of withdrawal, either for irrigation or drinking water, whatever it might be. Again, the challenge here for the TMDL program is to identify sometimes the critical conditions upon which we establish our TMDL.
Hey, Bruce.
Yeah.
This is Susan. Several people have written in that they're having a little trouble keeping up. If you're out there and you have not downloaded the slides ahead of time, you may want to go ahead back to the homepage of the seminar and download them into PowerPoint. They'll play faster if you have them loaded locally than if you're trying to go through your internet connection and click on each one and load them one at a time. So for those of you out there, please go to the picture of the homepage where Bruce is on it and click on the presentation and download a local copy of the PowerPoint if you haven't done so already. Okay, Bruce, please continue. Sorry to interrupt.
Okay, no, thank you, Susan. I'll try to pace myself here. Can you still hear me okay?
Yeah, we can hear you fine.
Terrific. Let me pick up on slide 26. This reminds us of another hot topic in the world of TMDL, and that is water temperature. In some regions of EPA are particularly struggling with this challenge of waters that are unduly heated because of solar radiation. This may be because of riparian or channel degradation or low flow, but it can result in negative effects on aquatic life, as we see in slide 27. In this case, we see the consequences of several things: high temperature, low flow, low DO, resulting in fish kills. In slide 28, we ask the question, how can we make sense of this maze we call the Clean Water Act? How do we enter this maze and come out with a full maximum daily load that can be a guiding light to us in our watershed restoration process? So let's turn to slide 29. Here we have a slide of a stream. And how can we, using the Clean Water Act approach, address the issues that might be impairing this particular stream, slide 29. Well, let's step back and take a look at the broad plan that is presented to us in the Clean Water Act, slide 30. In the Clean Water Act, there are two steps that are laid out, described, to achieve water quality goals. The first one I'd like to mention this afternoon is the technology-based approach. Technology-based controls are uniform, minimum pollutant controls that apply across the nation for particular sources. In other words, let me give you an example. The municipal treatment plant that treats the municipal waste from the city of San Francisco has to meet to a minimum level. That minimum level is the same that the municipal plant that treats the waste from, let's say, Rock Springs, Wyoming, has to treat. So whether you're in Rock Springs or San Francisco or New York or Bags, Wyoming or Bismarck, North Dakota, if you're a municipal facility, there's certain minimum requirements you have to meet, and those are technology-based controls. Whether you're a steel manufacturer in Gary, Indiana, or in Provo, Utah, as a steel manufacturing discharger, you have to meet certain minimum requirements also. In slide 31, we note that the Clean Water Act identifies technology-based controls for point sources as a starting point here. But to supplement the technology-based controls, the Clean Water Act also establishes what we call a water quality-based approach, where the technology-based controls are inadequate to achieve the goals of the Clean Water Act. Water quality-based controls are used. These, in contrast to the technology-based controls, are tailored to fit the particular needs of the particular watershed that you're dealing with. So they're watershed-specific or water body-specific controls to achieve water quality controls. As we see in slide 32, water quality-based controls apply to both point sources and non-point sources in the design of the Clean Water Act. But it should be noted that outside of the context of the Clean Water Act, you may find certain states or other approaches, technology-based approach for non-point sources, or even regulatory approaches on non-point sources at the state or local level. But in the construct of the Clean Water Act, these are the two steps that are to use to achieve water quality goals. Slide 33, then, indicates to us that this second step, the water quality-based control, this tailoring of our controls to the particular water body, to the particular watershed, to achieve goals, is the TMDL agenda. TMDLs look at the effects of both point sources and non-point sources in the context of the water quality approach to achieve the Clean Water Act goals. And it lays out kind of a plan of attack to achieve these goals. At this point, in slide 34, I'd like to take a break and solicit any questions that we might have. Susan?
That's it.
I don't know why. Any questions, anybody?
At the same time,
Yeah, we are. I don't understand what's the problem because we are already done.
Why don't we open PowerPoint?
Trying to get the file downloaded into PowerPoint.
Hello, Susan?
Yes, you back?
Hello, Susan?
Yes.
Yeah. Any questions through email or?
That page is not loading at the moment. I think maybe because a lot of people were going back to download the slides, I don't have the question page. It's not working at the moment.
Okay.
A little, 32.
Could everybody go ahead, please, and put your phones on mute unless you have a question to ask the group while we're on question period? All right, why don't you go ahead and continue on with slide 35, Bruce, and we'll continue to work on this.
Okay, thank you, Susan. When you open up EPA guidance on the TMDL program, of course, we're obligated to provide some level of definition of TMDL. So let's take a look at this. You'll find a discussion of TMDL definition both in EPA guidance as well as the TMDL regulations for this program. The good short definition of TMDL is the amount of a specific pollutant that a water body can receive and still meet water quality standards. Another way to put that is, what is an acceptable load of the pollutant so that we do maintain and attain water quality standards? In the second bullet, to some terminology here that we use in the TMDL program. TMDL is made up of the sum of the point source loads. We're going to call those waste load allocations. And the pollutant load associated with non-point sources and background sources. We're going to call that a load allocation. Also, by statute, TMDLs must include some margin of safety and also consider seasonality within its calculations. Now, the margin of safety can be either explicit or implicit in the calculation of the TMDL or the design of the TMDL. For you math majors out there, slide 36 is presented, the kind of definition of TMDL is presented in an equation form here, where summation of all the waste load allocation, acceptable waste load allocation loads, plus the acceptable load allocation loads, and either explicit or implicit margin of safety is going to equal the total maximum daily load, kind of the loading capacity of the receiving water that we're dealing with. Equation could be some additional set-aside loads, like a load for future growth, or future growth could be incorporated into either the waste load allocation or load allocation term. Slide 37, we see a little bit more of a schematic that kind of parses out what types of loads are under the title of waste load allocation versus load allocation. On the top of the slide, slide 37, we see that there are certainly point sources that are made up of stormwater. So much of the stormwater that we have starts out as a non-point source. But before it gets into surface waters, it's channeled through a ditch or a pipe, which then converts it to a bona fide point source. Such point sources would be included in the waste allocation component. Likewise, a point source discharges the pollutants from industries, from municipal plants. The non-stormwater type of discharges would also be part of this family of waste allocation loads. The bottom half of slide 37, we see a number of example load allocation components. Certainly the background load from the water body that we're dealing with qualifies as a load allocation component. But also inflow, let's say, from groundwater, from non-point source diffuse runoff. And by Clean Water Act definition, irrigated agriculture and return flow in, and also agricultural stormwater, even though it may come into the surface water, the irrigation ditch, a non-point source. Also, atmospheric deposition, like we mentioned before, coming into surface water, would be part of this load allocation component. This sorting of loads between waste allocation and load allocation helps us kind of queue up the TMDL for the types of controls that we might need to implement within a watershed. So what is our goal? What is the water quality goal that a TMDL should use? How clean should the water be if we were to implement a TMDL? Well, let's take a look at number 38 slide. Here is a short panel on water quality standards. Now, water quality standards established by states and authorized tribes, I guess I would describe would be the sun in the Clean Water Act solar system. It's the target for so many of the programs in the Clean Water Act. It defines our goal in terms of the uses, the quality that are supposed to be supported. Let's take a look at this slide a little bit closer. Water quality standards established by a state or an authorized tribe include various components. And all of these components are important to the TMDL development process. They're made up of use classifications that apply to surface waters. They're made up of numeric standards that include some indication of magnitude of the pollutant that's acceptable, acceptable frequency, exceedance frequency, as well as an averaging period associated with that number, that numeric standard, or you could say a duration. The standards are also made up of narrative components that are important for many of the TMDLs that we're developing. And standards are also made up of anti-degradation provisions to be protective of high-quality waters and to maintain current existing uses. There's a whole lecture just on this concept of water quality standards. But the point I'm making today is that TMDLs are obliged to take a look at all facets, all components of water quality standards, making sure that these are your guiding light for developing a TMDL. As we go on to slide 39, we go into section 303D of the Clean Water Act, where we find the TMDL program described. TMDL requirements are imposed on states in this part of the Clean Water Act, and it's really a two-step process if I were to boil it down to two steps here. The first step is to identify where you have water quality issues. In other words, identify impaired and threatened water bodies in your state, or if you're an authorized tribe within your tribal boundaries. The second step, then, is once you've identified those issues, develop a TMDL for those water bodies and those pollutants. In other words, establish some sort of solution or plan to address those impaired water bodies. So number one, identify your problems. Number two, come up with solutions. In slide 40, reminded that first step, this identification of impaired and threatened water bodies, is what we call the identification of the state's 303D water body list, a list of impaired and threatened water bodies. And we'll get into this in just a moment, a little bit more detail. Slide 41 provides us an example of the type of information we would see on a state's 303D list. This is just an excerpt from one of Colorado's 303D water bodies list. On this 303D list, you would see certainly identification of water bodies. You'd see identification of the pollutants that are causing the impairment or the threat. And by law, states are to identify the basic priority used for development of the TMDL for these water bodies. Again, this is only an excerpt. State lists of 303D water bodies can be as small as 100, 200 water bodies, or it can climb quite a bit from there. Slide 42 reminds us that this 303D water body list of impaired and threatened water bodies is due every 2 years. In fact, every 2 years, every even year. So the next 303D list across the nation is due April 1st of 2006. It's due to EPA for review and approval. All right. Slide 43, again, identifies this two-step process in Section 33D of the Clean Water Act. But let's expand on this two-step process a little bit more. Let's go to slide 44.
Can I ask the people who are making noise to please mute their personal phones? Thank you.
Slide 44, what I'm going to try to show is the kind of the grand design in Title III of the Clean Water Act. 303C of the Clean Water Act addresses this need on the part of states and authorized tribes to establish water quality standards. EPA then receives those standards and reviews and either approves or disapproves those standards. And if EPA disagrees with the standards, do we have authority under the Clean Water Act to promulgate our own water quality standards for that state or tribe? Right next door to 303C is 303D, as we see in slide 45. There is a kind of a parallel between the authority of EPA under water quality standards and TMDLs. TMDLs, again, are established by states and authorized tribes, and EPA reviews and either approves or disapproves those TMDLs. And if EPA disagrees with a particular TMDL, it has the authority to establish that TMDL for and instead of the state or tribe. 546 then introduces us to the next part of the Clean Water Act here, and that's in Section 303E. And here we see the next step of the process, and that is actually reading life into these standards and these TMDLs, bringing them into some program of implementation. In other words, establishing or implementing water quality controls to achieve those TMDLs, to achieve those water quality standards. This is kind of the linear flow that we see from 303C, 303D, 303E. Under this title of water quality controls, though, I want to make a point here that a TMDL will, again, rely on a mix of regulatory or non-regulatory, another way to put it is voluntary approaches to achieving water quality goals. It could be regulatory through a permitting program, such as the point source permitting program. It could be voluntary, which many non-point source management programs are. Anyway, it could be any number of types of controls that are put together to achieve the TMDL, to achieve water quality standards. This, again, presents kind of a linear program, but in slide 47, I want to provide a little bit more color to the whole flow of the water quality-based approach. As we find in the Clean Water Act, the very top bubble gives us our first step here, and that's assessing our waters based on water quality standards. Second bubble, identifying impaired and threatened waters. That's development of the 303D list. And the third step, developing TMDLs for those waters. Fourth step, implementing water quality controls. This is the water quality-based approach in total. And as you notice, it is circular. It's ongoing. It kind of never ends because we're always supposed to be in a mode of assessing our waters, identifying problems, coming up with solutions, implementing those controls. So it's more of a circular process than it is linear that I've indicated in the previous slides. Slide 48 is another question slide. So let's, Susan, let's see if there's any questions at this point.
Okay. I have a question from Susan in South Carolina that she submitted online. And she wants to know if each state defines its own criteria for removal of a site from its 303D list, if a TMDL has been approved, or if it's been implemented, or if it's been attained. You want me to read it again?
You know, EPA... Yeah, and it indicates in its regulation, we believe also the Clean Water Act, that a water body can come off the 303D list once EPA approves a TMDL. So states have that option of delisting a water body once they receive approval of the TMDL. The TMDL does not have to be implemented, neither does it have to be proven to be effective by now water quality standards being met before the water comes off the list. Once that TMDL comes off the list. Now, I believe in our EPA guidance to states is that they can elect to keep a water body on the list, but it doesn't have to stay on the list. I guess my experience is that states really like to take water bodies off their list once they receive that EPA approval of TMDL.
Okay, great. And there's also another question. Who makes the determination as to how to decide whether TMDL has in fact been implemented and or attained?
This goes back to our slide 47 of the water quality-based approach. In order to really test the effectiveness of TMDL, you would have to, I would presume, do some level of modeling or monitoring of the situation to see whether your goals are actually being met. Again, this can be done based on EPA guidance through either monitoring, going out to the watershed to see how effective it is, or in some cases we have to rely on modeling to determine that. But it's incumbent upon the state's monitoring program, or if they can also obtain assistance through a voluntary monitoring network or other agencies to keep somewhat of a gauge on water quality, they can get information that way. But Section 303D of the Clean Water Act, the TMDL program, actually is meant to achieve development or put in place TMDLs. That is the fundamental requirement under Section 303D. We have to go beyond 303D to see where the state's monitoring program really is at play here.
Okay, great. Does anyone have on the telephone have a question they'd like to ask Bruce at this time?
Yes, a question for Region 5.
Okay, go ahead, Region 5.
On slide number 46, water quality controls under the 303E program, who has the lead for implementation there, the state or EPA?
303E indicates it's incumbent upon the state to put together this whole master plan of how it's going to implement controls on point sources and non-point sources through all its regulatory and voluntary programs. So it's coming upon the state to do that. If you read closely in Section 303E, you see that states put together this grand design through a document, what is called the continuing planning process, another way of integrating all the various components of a state's water quality program into this grand design, this program. So the answer would be it's coming upon the state to put this together.
Okay, thanks. I don't have background on water programs. I'm from different programs, so that's why I'm coming up with this basic question. Thank you very much.
Oh, thank you for the question.
Does anyone else on the telephone have a question they'd like to ask Bruce at this time?
Yes, I have a question. Under what circumstances can an agricultural runoff become a point source?
I'm not familiar with, as long as it's bona fide agricultural runoff, then it is considered a non-point source. Now, you might be seeing some recent attention given to animal feeding operations. This is certainly agricultural in nature, and EPA has been working on regulations to define what constitutes this source, where we have concentrated animal feeding operations that could rise to the level of a point source that would be under a regulatory program, although many facets of that program have yet to be defined. That is one example, I guess, of where, runoff, but usually runoff is defined as something that comes into surface water as diffuse. But in this case, in animal feeding operations, many of them do channelize the runoff from the animal feeding area into a pipe or ditch, in which case animal feeding operations, in particular concentrated animal feeding operations of certain sizes, do qualify as point sources.
Okay.
Question from Region 9.
Okay, go ahead, Region 9.
The slide number 41, question about how the priority is set.
Cool. Yeah, that's a good question, because in our regulation, the preamble to our TMDL regulation, we address this issue. Actually, the Clean Water Act states that states should ascribe priorities based on the use for which the water body is classified. You know, is it classified for drinking water or aquatic life? But also the severity of the pollutant problem or threat. But EPA in our preamble to our regulation says that states can supplement those two criteria for prioritization with other priorities. In other words, there may be an administrative requirement that they get a TMDL done, or there may be a court order that is prescribing a certain priority. Or they may want to pay attention to a particular watershed where the stakeholders are ready to move forward and the time is ripe. So they may move that to the top of the TMDL development list. So in our preamble language, we mentioned that EPA gives some discretion to states to develop a prioritization criteria, but as a baseline, they must keep in mind uses for which the water body is classified and the severity of the threat or impairment.
Are there other questions on the telephone?
Yes, I have one.
Okay, please go ahead.
How are conflicts for use classifications for adjacent water bodies handled? For example, if one water body has they've set the water quality standards for irrigation, while one downstream may have it set for recreational purposes, and they have different standards, and they obviously impact one another, or at least the downstream one is impacted. In your slide 42, there's a number of different water bodies on, for example, the Eagle River, where they may or may not have different use classifications. How is that handled?
Typically, how that is handled is we lay out the various uses for which the water body is classified. It may be one segment that is classified for multiple uses, and often that is the case. But also have to look at the far field, you know, what are the uses downstream, because there may be a critical use for which the water body is classified downstream. And we take the most limiting use on a pollutant-by-pollutant basis. If you open up state standards, you'll see that there are drinking water standards for zinc. But you'll also notice that there are aquatic life standards for zinc. Aquatic life criteria for zinc trump drinking water standards for zinc, and usually drive the particular TMDL. So we look at the most limiting use on a pollutant by pollutant basis. Does that answer your question?
Yes, it does. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right, Bruce, I have another question submitted by someone online. They would like to know how much water is protected by water quality standards nationally. They didn't say, if they want acreage or in what manner to measure it, but how much water is protected by water quality standards now?
Well, that's a very good question, because theoretically all surface waters are to be covered by state or tribal water quality standards. Let's put the tribal issue aside for a second here. It's incumbent upon the state to ascribe water quality standards to all surface waters. But what constitutes waters of the U.S. or waters of the state is a lecture in itself. Because we get into this issue of, let's say, wetlands, marginal streams, isolated water bodies, and there's been some very recent litigation over the last 4 or 5 years that have raised questions. But generally speaking, all surface waters of a state are supposed to be covered. Now, what we find, though, is tribal waters, not all tribes, in fact, the minority of tribes are authorized to establish water quality standards for their waters. So as you lay a map out of the United States, many of those waters are not covered by EPA-approved standards to date, and EPA is working with tribes to establish standards for those waters. Most recently in our region, we just approved the Yuen Mountain Ute standards within the last 10 days. But there are many tribes. Should we continue?
Yes, go ahead, Bruce.
Okay, let's go with slide 49.
Hey, Bruce, I'll tell you what. I'm going to go ahead and mute the group, and then you're going to, can you unmute yourself?
You bet, yeah.
Okay, hang on 1 second.
Okay, let's continue with slide 49. So you say, Bruce, you're talking to me about impaired and threatened waters, you know, the ugly waters. Well, let's go to at 50. How about the beautiful waters? How about the waters that are currently meeting water quality standards? How do we find out about those waters? So let me just segue a little bit into this thing we call the integrated report. EPA in slide 51 has instituted this new terminology we call the integrated report over the last 5 or 6 years. And this is an opportunity for state and tribes to report on all waters within their states and tribal waters. The slide 52 indicates that the 303D list, this list of impaired and threatened waters that need TMDLs, is a component of the integrated report that talks about, you know, the good, bad, and ugly. But in slide 53, we also see that the state incorporates what we call the 305B report into the integrated report. And this is a report that is more broad in scope. It reports on the overall health of water bodies within the state or the authorized tribe area. Slide 54 also indicates that the 314 report, if a state has an assessment report on lakes and reservoirs within its boundaries, this would also be part of the state's integrated report. So slide 55 indicates that, again, all three of these components, 303D list, the 305B report, and the 314 report, all having to do with assessment of water body, whether they're clean waters or dirty waters, are included and discussed within a state's integrated report. As you can imagine, this report then is due April 1st of every even-numbered year, coincidental with the requirement of 305B reports and 303D lists. So states have got an option to incorporate all these assessment reports in under one cover called the integrated report. Slide 56 also indicates that EPA asked the states and the authorized tribes to classify the water bodies into one of five categories. And we've issued guidance on this, and again, that's another lecture in itself. But let me just indicate that of the five categories of waters that we ask states to classify or use in their classification, it's Category 5 that's important to us TMDL folks, because it's Category 5 that is really makes up the 303D list. It identifies the impaired and threatened water bodies, waters that need TMDLs. Okay? Slide 57 indicates that. So when you think Category 5 in an integrated report, also think 303D water body list. Slide 58. Rumor has it that if your water body has an EPA-approved TMDL, that your fish are going to be bigger. But that's only a rumor, I think. I'm using this as kind of a transition slide. So if you can handle it, let's move into the topic of TMDL development. Slide 59, TMDL 101 here. Basic provisions of TMDLs. TMDLs are designed to attain and maintain applicable water quality standards. We saw that before where it's water quality standards provide our water quality goals. TMDLs apply to both point and non-point sources. We heard that. TMDLs apply to all pollutants. And TMDLs are done on a pollutant-by-pollutant basis. So in other words, they're pollutant-specific. And as such, that last bullet, a water body will often have several TMDLs. One TMDL for each pollutant of concern. So there may be a pollutant for zinc to address the zinc loads, and there may also be a TMDL in that same water body to address nutrients or something like sediment. And they may not all be done at the same time. It may be we may have all the information to develop that zinc TMDL and move forward with solving that problem, but we still may have to go out and collect information and data to support, let's say, a sediment TMDL. So they may be done at different times, and they may also cover different geographic scales, too. Slide 60 is just an excerpt from EPA regulations. We indicate in our regulations that TMDLs can be described, as you can imagine, pounds per day, you know, mass per time. TMDLs can be described in terms of toxicity. But they can also be described in other measures that are appropriate for your particular water body or pollutant. such as perhaps a percent reduction of a particular pollutant. We'll see in our case examples coming up how these various bullets can be used in TMDL development. Slide 61 also indicates to us that TMDLs are not self-implementing. What I mean by that is even if EPA were to approve a TMDL, there's really no new implementing authorities behind that plan. TMDLs have to rely on the current programs, the current statutory mechanisms that are already in place to be implemented. EPA's approval of a TMDL doesn't create new implementing authorities. But it's important to note that TMDLs do set the stage for implementation. They kind of guide us through what needs to be done in terms of what acceptable pollutant loads are so that we can attain our goals. As we mentioned before, the implementation tools that can be used to implement a TMDL can range from regulatory permits, federal, state, or local laws, but we can also have voluntary-based actions that underpins the implementation of a TMDL. I know in our region, out of Denver, almost all of the non-point source or TMDLs that address non-point sources rely on voluntary mechanisms to get the job done. Slide 62 addresses one little aspect of TMDLs. As you can imagine, there is some level of uncertainty about whether the TMDL will actually get the job done. Now, when we read in the Clean Water Act, it kind of responds to that level of uncertainty that we may have about the effectiveness of the TMDL by saying, well, you need to have a margin of safety to address that uncertainty. The larger the uncertainty, the larger the margin of safety within your TMDL. Because we have to assure that if these TMDLs are to be implemented, that they'll have a reasonable likelihood of achieving their target, water quality standards. We can also rely on what we call the phased TMDL approach. Now, the phased TMDL approach still sets the sites to achieve water quality standards within the watershed. But what is kicked into action here in a phased TMDL is the acknowledgement that we may have to revisit this TMDL in the future once we monitor its effectiveness within within the watershed and perhaps revisit or change the TMDL if it is not achieving water quality standards. Again, because the fundamental here is that all TMDLs have to be designed to achieve these water quality standards or have a reasonable likelihood that they'll achieve those water quality standards. And I want to contrast uncertainty with variability. And I'll get into this topic of variability in just a moment, one of the additional slides here. With that slide 63 offers another opportunity for questions at this point.
Okay, I have a couple of questions that have been written in, Bruce. One is, once 303D listed, what is the time frame to develop a TMDL? What penalty is there in complying or not complying?
Very good question. We really don't see a requirement in statute, in the Clean Water Act, you know, how soon, once a water body pollutant combination is on the 303D list, does a state have to establish TMDL. But in EPA guidance, we've kind of laid out what we think is a reasonable approach, a reasonable time frame. In EPA guidance, we say that a state really should establish a TMDL for a water body pollutant combination, once it's on the 303D list, within an 8 to 13 year time frame. 8 to 13 years is the time frame that we mentioned in the EPA guidance. There also in that same guidance is some option for maybe extending it 13 years. But 8 to 13 years, keep that in mind as EPA's kind of guidance in terms of establishing TMDL. If EPA feels that a state has gone too long without establishing TMDL, there is a way for EPA then, as a consequence, to establish a TMDL for that state, for that particular water body and pollutant combination. That would be, I guess what you could say as a consequence, as the TMDL, EPA had, under the appropriate conditions, can step in and establish that for the state.
Okay. We have another question. This question is specific to slide 56. Please explain category 4, impaired, threatened, but no TMDL is needed. Why would none be needed?
Oh, that's a good question, too. Category 4 are impaired or threatened waters, too, but you may not need a TMDL for several reasons. Number one, a TMDL is already done. You already have an EPA-approved TMDL for that water body pollutant combination, and you can take it off the 330 list, like I mentioned before. It comes off of Category 5 and goes into Category 4. It is no longer on the state's 330 list because you have an TMDL that already addresses that water body. Another reason, you might take it off of Category 5, but it's still being impaired or threatened, it gets into this issue of what we call other pollutant requirements. And you have to go into EPA TMDL regulation to really see an explanation of this. A state can say that there are other pollutant requirements that are adequate to attain water quality standards. In other words, there already may be a requirement in place or a plan in place that will be implemented that is sufficient. So if the state can show to us that that plan or that alternative pollutant requirement is adequate to achieve water quality standards for this 330 listed water body pollutant combination, it can also come off the 330 list. We call that the 4B category of waters. And there may be some examples of that. Even in the non-point source world, we're saying that if one example may be where all the water quality controls are actually in place, and it's been shown that those controls will already achieve, with time, the water quality standards, then EPA can take a look at that with the state and consider that for delisting off the 303 list and into Category 4. Another category under Category 4 is 4C, a subcategory. And this is a little bit more complicated. TMDLs, by EPA's interpretation of the Clean Water Act, are meant to be done to address what we call pollutants. Now, there are some situations where a pollutant is not causing the impairment or threat. Let's say it's only because of, let's say, physical habitat. A water body has been channelized, and it has been lined by concrete. And because of that, you have no aquatic life. But yet the standards for this water body is aquatic life support. The water quality is just fine, but the habitat is inappropriate. We don't call that a pollutant problem. And because of that, it's not requiring a TMDL, even though it may be impaired. So a state can exclude that water body from its 330 list, too, because it's not a pollutant that's causing the problem. It's what we call a non-pollutant pollution rather than a pollutant. So hopefully that provides a little bit of flavor about what is in Category 4.
Okay, and I'm going to ask one more from the online list. Can a state require a TMDL on a water body that is not listed on the 3OD list for that parameter?
Well, states are the ones that develop TMDLs, and so I'm not sure who they would require to do a TMDL outside themselves, because they're the ones that are developing the TMDLs. And when you read Section 303D of the Clean Water Act, states do have the authority to establish TMDLs for any water body, any pollutant, even if it's not on the 303D list. The difference is if they establish a TMDL for that water body pollutant combination that is not on the 330 list, the states do not have to or do not submit that for EPA review and approval. But they are given license to, under the Clean Water Act, to develop a TMDL anywhere within their state.
Okay, great. I'm going to now open it up for questions on the phone. Does anyone on the telephone lines have a question for Bruce? And everybody is now off of mute. Anyone in one of the conference rooms or anywhere have a question for Bruce?
Hi.
Okay.
Can you hear me?
Yes.
Slide 60. The last one is other measure. Can you elaborate a little bit more? I don't have clear picture of that. Percentage reduction?
Sure, you bet. A lot of our non-point source, either nutrient or sediment TMDLs rely on this measure. Sometimes you can take a look at a stream health and through the either biological data or the physical or chemical data, know that you need to reduce a particular load by, let's say, 50%. You haven't got an opportunity to go out and monitor over, let's say, several years, what the non-point source load is. So much of the non-point source load is driven by stormwater. You don't have the opportunity to go out and actually quantify what your current, let's say, pounds per year, or maybe even pounds per day on an average, might be for that particular pollutant. But you do have some way to back into knowing that you need to reduce the load by a certain percentage. And in EPA's guidance on sediment TMDLs and nutrient TMDLs, it talks about how this might be done. With this percentage reduction, it can still help you identify you know, the sources of the pollutant and the degree to which you need to apply controls to achieve your percentage reduction. I wish we had a little bit more time to get into this, but again, this is used a lot where we can't quantify the actual load itself.
So this will be established by state or EPA?
By state. This would be one way that the state can articulate their TMDL that they submit to EPA.
Okay, thanks.
All right, Bruce, let me go ahead and unmute the group, and you can go ahead on to the next slide, and then you can unmute yourself.
Thank you. We're picking up with slide 64. You might ask, when EPA receives a TMDL, what do we look at to determine whether this TMDL is approvable by EPA or not? And let me introduce the bullets on slide 64 as review criteria that EPA uses as kind of a checklist to determine whether the TMDL is approvable or not. And this is linked back to EPA guidance, and we've got somewhat of a kind of a checklist also in EPA's website, TMDL website, and we'll be getting to that address later in the talk. I'm not going to go bullet by bullet here, but this just is to indicate there are certain things we look at when TMDL is submitted to us for review and approval. But one important thing I want to mention, though, is what is below the line on this slide, and that is what we call the implementation plan. It's EPA's interpretation of the Clean Water Act that an actual implementation plan is not a required element of a TMDL. In other words, we can identify what the significant sources are, what the target is, what the acceptable loads are, and what the waste load allocations are, and what the load allocations are, but then what is the next step in implementation? That implementation plan is not a required element by law of a TMDL, but what we see so often is that a state will take that extra step and actually have some level of at least discussion, if not a full-blown implementation plan. That makes the TMDL a lot more satisfying to the public that are reviewing the TMDL. If they review TMDL and they say, well, what is the next step? What does this mean to me, let's say, a landowner or a farmer or a rancher or a municipality? That is most revealed through an implementation plan. So, again, implementation plans are not a required element of a TMDL, but we certainly suggest that a state does consider including implementation plans as part of, at least on a concept basis, with the TMDL as part of the submittal to EPA. We're not going to take action. We're not going to disapprove if the implementation plan is not part of the package, certainly. Slide 65 reminds me of the kind of the art of TMDLing. Part of the art of TMDLing is to know when to take that balloon higher and look at the full watershed, maybe the full basin, to look at the cumulative impacts of all the sources within the watershed to establish a TMDL that addresses all significant sources within the watershed. Sometimes we have to drop the balloon and take a closer look, though, at the particular situation. There may be some details that we may miss unless we take a close look at the situation. Let me give some examples of what I mean here. Let's go on to slide 66. Here we have a photograph of the Columbia River. This is home to what I call the mother of all TMDLs when it comes to the geographic scope of TMDLs. There are very few TMDLs that have addressed this geographic scope. We see on slide 67 a map of the area that was covered by the Columbia River Basin dioxin TMDL. This TMDL addressed a multi-state. In fact, it was international in scope. It even acknowledged some of the dioxin load that was coming from a source up in Canada. Slide 68 indicates to us that this would fall under what EPA would call a complex TMDL. EPA introduced the concept of simple and complex TMDLs in one of its preamble to its regulation. This particular TMDL, the Columbia River Basin TMDL, would fall under the category of a complex TMDL just because of its scale alone, but also because of the persistency of the pollutant, dioxin. It's complex. It's also complex because it's multi-jurisdictional, and there are also multiple sources involved here that have to be controlled to achieve the dioxin water quality standards here. So it constitutes a complex TMDL. There are situations, though, where we need to maybe focus in a little bit, and rightly so, need to still define acceptable pollutant loads to ensure water quality standards are met, but it's a little bit simpler of a scenario. Let's go to slide 69. Here we have a situation where an ammonia TMDL is done to address the very issue of what is an acceptable load of ammonia, an aquatic life toxicant, to Chugwater Creek, such that ammonia standards are maintained and attained. In slide 70, we see that this constitutes more of a simple TMDL. But even in simple TMDLs, we must consider all significant sources of the particular pollutant we are addressing. Let's walk through this TMDL. Because it is a simple, we can maybe look at the various components of a TMDL. In slide 71, we see our first step at establishing a TMDL for Chugwater Creek for ammonia is to figure out, well, what is the target that we're shooting for? What is the acceptable concentration of ammonia established by, in this case, the state of Wyoming, such that we're protective of aquatic life use? In this case, when we go to the state of Wyoming standards, we see that for this situation, 29 microgram per liter of ammonia is the target that we're shooting for here. We have to make sure that under conditions here in Chugwater Creek that we attain this quality of ammonia. Going to slide 72 gives us a little bit more components of the TMDL. First of all, we can calculate the total maximum daily load for ammonia in terms of pounds per day, knowing the critical low flow condition of this of the Chugwater Creek. Knowing the total maximum daily load, in this case 7.2 pounds per day of ammonia, gives us a guide here. Our next step in this TMDL is to figure out, well, what are the sources of ammonia within this watershed? And we'll see that the upstream or the background condition is not very many pounds of ammonia per day. It's only 0.9 pounds per day. And so that's our load allocation, our articulation of our non-point source and natural background loads of ammonia. And we're just going to set that aside. That's our load allocation. Knowing the load allocation, the TMDL, we now know what the waste allocation is for this particular situation. What is the acceptable load coming from the Chugwater Municipal Treatment Plant, which is the source of high levels of ammonia, such that we maintain ammonia standards in the stream? Based on modeling and calculation, we see that the waste allocation here is 6.3 pounds per day of ammonia. We can achieve standards by applying this level of control just to the municipal plant at Chugwater. So this is kind of a simple situation, but it kind of display some of the principles behind the TMDL. TMDL having to address all significant sources, and in particular indicating where we need to apply controls to achieve the ambient water quality standard. If we go to slide 73, we can take this kind of schematic that I laid out for Chugwater Creek and lay it into this linear approach that we were looking at earlier. The water quality standard in slide 73 is 29 microgram per liter of ammonia. We've got the various components of a TMDL, a waste allocation, load allocation. In this case, the margin of safety is implicit rather than explicit. And we also have water quality controls. In this case, water quality controls are applied to just the point source through the permitting program to achieve water quality standards. Now, if Chugwater wanted to set aside a certain component for, let's say, future growth, they might set aside certain pounds per day of ammonia for future growth, either within the waste allocation term or maybe even the load allocation term, or set aside a certain amount explicitly added to this equation. Slide 74 gives us an example of a copper TMDL in the Caslapuda River in Colorado. In this case, the state of Colorado established a TMDL to determine appropriate effluent limits for the industry Kodak and also the city of Windsor. But in order to do that, they had to be cognizant of everything that happens between Kodak and Windsor's discharge. They had to be cognizant of the seepage, the upstream loads, the loads that were coming in through agricultural ditches. So it becomes a little bit more of a complex situation to establish load allocations and waste allocations for this particular TMDL. One step up of complexity here in terms of the copper TMDL. Because copper was a particular pollutant that was a common denominator found both in Windsor and Kodak's discharge. Slide 75 presents us with just a side note I'd like to mention here. Most water quality standards throughout the nation established by states have standards having to do with mixing zones. When you have a point source discharge into a water body, so often you don't have complete mix. And as we see in slide 75 here, we have a kind of a mixing plume. States oftentimes are trying to be protective of this zone of mixing. So often this zone of mixing is ecologically sensitive, or further downstream there may even be a drinking water intake that we have to be cognizant of. So when the TMDL is established for this water body, we have to look at, as I mentioned before, all water quality is established for this water body, and that may include having to establish acceptable loads based on the mixing zone standards of a state also. It's just kind of a side note. Let's go to question slide number 76. Susan, are there other questions out there?
We do, Bruce. And we have two questions submitted online that are rather similar. One is, are simple and complex TMDLs defined by the states or by EPA?
EPA is the one that introduced this terminology, and we won't really see it used in an everyday context by states, but this is just for today's presentation to give you the kind of the ends of the spectrum of the type of TMDLs that are submitted to us from the states. So states won't, let's say, label a TMDL as simple or complex. So this is really used as demonstrating the rainbow or the range of types of TMDLs in terms of complexity that we do get submitted to us.
Okay, because the other person wanted to know if there were any concessions or anything a state got for issuing a complex TMDL.
We really should think about, you know, annual TMDL awards, you know, that we should hand out, because there are some TMDLs that are actually volumes of text here because of the complexity that we should really acknowledge, that really struggle with some tough issues. Right now there are no concessions, but maybe we should think about the annual TMDL awards by EPA, huh?
Well, this person even asked if there was something a state could do to highlight, you know, to EPA that they had complex TMDLs, so they must obviously feel the same way.
Yeah, right.
All right, I'm going to go ahead and unmute the group and see if we have questions on the telephone lines. Like to ask Bruce a question at this time?
So I was curious on the complex TMDLs. Has EPA ever considered doing anything for something like the Gulf of Mexico as a complex, kind of a national or a regional TMDL?
Yes. Yeah, we certainly are thinking about it. The hypoxia issue in the Gulf of Mexico is a good example of where we really need to be looking at the full upstream loads of nutrients coming in there. And there's a whole multi-state and EPA and other federal agencies involved in that effort. You know, what are acceptable loads of, in this case, nutrients to address that type of issue? EPA is concerned about that and, working with all the states within that whole basin to address an issue, really tough issue like that. Another example would be the Chesapeake Bay area, where EPA has taken good leadership role, but also relying on the strong leadership from the states to identify acceptable loads from surface waters, as well as looking at atmospheric deposition of nutrients into Chesapeake Bay. I'm not involved in that process, but I read where that is certainly a complex TMDL, involves not only coordinating among water programs, but also air quality programs. So that's another, I think, a water body that's a topic of TMDL in the future.
Okay, great. Does anyone else on the telephone have a question?
Yes, once a TMDL has been determined for a stream and the problem sources have been identified, how do you determine the percentage of the total load that those sources will receive?
There's going to be a series of slides talking about allocation methods that I'll be talking about that will in part address that question. So often, let's say it's a non-point source, we rely heavily on stakeholder involvement to determine, where do we feel the biggest bang for the buck is in terms of source control? Where are we going to find people that are willing to cooperatively work with the effort of cleaning up within the watershed? Not everyone is willing to cooperate. So that's another issue that we have to address within the TMDL world. How we split up that TMDL pie is not a part of anything that EPA prescribed. In other words, we haven't come out with guidance on our own saying this is how you must split up the TMDL pie and split up the allocation. Rather, we've indicated different ways that you might approach that issue as a state that's developing the TMDL. But how that is to be split up should be part of the TMDL itself and not really follow the TMDL. That should be part of the TMDL submittal to EPA. But again, EPA doesn't prescribe the allocation. Rather, we indicate what are some of those options. And I'll be talking about some of those options later on in the presentation.
Okay, then a part B would be, how do you determine what is set aside for future growth?
That should be done in conjunction with talking to the jurisdictions within the watershed. What are their plans of growth? How can we forecast that? Sometimes you can use models to forecast. Sometimes you just set aside a particular allocation based on your best professional judgment. But that can be a real tough one, as you can imagine. EPA is trying to develop some guidance on when do we need to go back and revisit a TMDL? When does a TMDL become stale and is no longer serving us well? And one of those reasons may be that we've seen undue growth within the watershed, and we need to go back and revisit that and adjust it to reflect that. But it's a tough situation, but where we've seen it done before, it's usually done in consultation with local jurisdictions, local planning groups, and certainly stakeholders within the watershed.
Okay, great. Bruce, I'm going to go ahead and mute the group, and you can unmute yourself in a second and move on to the next slide.
Slide 77 introduces us into this concept of TMDLs that address non-point sources, the diffuse type of of sources. And so many of those types of sources within in our region, out of Denver, are agricultural in nature. Let's go to slide 78. Who me pollutes is the typical cry we hear. And so we work with agricultural watersheds in this example to come up with strategies that identify the water quality issues and what are some reasonable approaches to addressing those issues. As we see on the bar chart given in slide 79, this is a national picture of the type of pollutants that need to be addressed under the TMDL program. In other words, this identifies the type of pollutants that we'll see collectively in all the state 303D lists across the nation. If we were to add up all the water body pollutant combinations, we'll see that there are more than, and this is the current count, over 60,000 TMDLs that need to be done to address all these. Quite the job. But let's take a look. What I want to focus on today are the type of pollutants that are represented by this bar chart. This first bar includes so many waters that have recently been put on 303D lists because of mercury impairments. In fact, I think a good third of that bar is due to mercury itself. The other two-thirds of that bar are other inorganics or other metals that have been identified by states that are impairing or threatening water bodies throughout the nation. Pathogens such as fecal coliform is number two bar. Nutrients is number three bar for now. And sediment is number four bar. It's still a very prominent pollutant throughout the nation that are being addressed by TMDLs. Slide 80 is a slide of a water body that is impaired by, in this case, too much sediment, and that's revealed through impairments in aquatic life, by, in particular, the fish community within this water body. Slide 81. In 1941, Orson Welles' movie Citizen Kane was given the Academy Award for innovativeness. They recognized through the Academy Awards the innovativeness that were used by Orson Welles in filming Citizen Kane. Up till now, films were pretty much filmed on sound stages where there was limited camera movements, and there had to be boom mics right above the actors to pick up the sound. In Citizen Kane, you actually saw ceilings in certain scenes. They used, in this movie, innovative approaches. They used camera equipment that could take low angles. The big thing about Citizen Kane, among other things, is the innovativeness that they used. They fought outside the box to accomplish the task. TMDLs, these days, often have to rely on innovativeness. They have to use new technical and watershed tools to get the job done. Recognizing the importance of stakeholder involvement, recognizing the social and sometimes cultural context that they're developing the TMDL in, and come up with innovative ways to communicate the whole TMDL process within the watershed. And we've seen certain TMDL efforts rely on that innovativeness to get the job done. This innovativeness so often has to be employed in non-point source TMDLs. Let's go back and focus on this issue of sediment, slide 82. In part, TMDLs are not, sediment TMDLs are not given from state standards a numeric target to shoot for. In other words, how can we express what the acceptable loads or the ambient, how much is too much sediment and how much is an acceptable level of sediment within a water body? We don't, so often we're not given that numeric criteria or numeric standards. So we have to look at, as a first step in the sediment TMDL development process, how are we going to express acceptable levels of sediment so that we support all the uses, whether it be drinking water, aquatic life, agricultural use. Many ways that states approach their sediment TMDLs is actually coming up with criteria or endpoints or targets for the TMDL. Are given in these bullets here. Sometimes they express acceptable level of sediment within the water column. certain milligrams per liter, let's say, or turbidity unit in the water column, they may look at the substrate, the bottom, the benthic area, and establish an acceptable amount of sediment at the bottom. They may use surrogate measures such as biological integrity or morphological or channel form stability measures or riparian measures as surrogates of sediment health within the watershed. That's just kind of a starting point where a sediment TMDL may have to be fairly innovative based on the type of data information that's available to the folks that are developing TMDL to establish a sediment target. Our experience in sediment TMDLs is revealed somewhat in slide 83. Here is just an example using, again, this motif of water quality controls to TMDLs to water quality controls. Examples of how water quality goals have been expressed or articulated in TMDLs. And I'll let you read those on your own. But this slide also presents how some of the TMDLs have been expressed to us, using fairly innovative ways that are relevant to the particular sediment problem in that watershed, in that water body. Again, I won't go through those in detail, but just to say that sometimes we have to think out of the box to express a sediment TMDL or sediment goals that still link back to achieving, supporting the uses for which the water body is classified. Let's look at a particular example of a sediment TMDL starting with slide 84. This was the first sediment TMDL that we approved in this region back in 1996. Here we have a situation where Deep Creek is the impaired water body, but it was a very ecologically important water body within the scheme of things. It was a water body that a lot of trout used for rearing and reproduction in the Missouri River system. It was a small enough stream where it was very important for support of the trout population in the Missouri River system. But it was impaired because of sediment in large part. I believe this was a successful TMDL. Why? Because from the very beginning, it relied on a stakeholder process to get the job done. Slide 85, we lined up all the actors here, and it included the landowners, ranchers, farmers. We had EPA involved. We had the USDA NRCS involved in this TMDL. We also had Montana State University help with some of the technical review and field monitoring and data collection. So again, I guess the point I want to make here is stakeholder process was very important to the success of this TMDL. It was basically a TMDL that was cobbled together, again, with the help of Montana State University in particular, working with the landowners, stakeholder-driven process. What did they use as their endpoints of success in this TMDL? We see that in slide 86. That was their first stop in this TMDL process. Their first challenge was to identify how are we going to measure the success of this TMDL? How will we know that the patient has come back to full health? And they identified certain substrate sediment targets, certain water temperature targets, and also biometric, a certain amount of trout population in Deep Creek to judge success. So the intent is that these are the thermometers in the patient's mouth that we use to judge success to make sure that the patient is coming back to health. Slide 87 expands a little bit more on the nature of this TMDL, showing the various ways that the TMDL was expressed and also revealing a little bit what was included in the TMDL in terms of the type of controls that were going to be used. All these water quality controls that were discussed in the TMDL document are voluntary in nature. None of these are regulatory in nature. They're just going to use a voluntary approach to establish or to actually go forward and implement these controls. Let's go to another example of another TMDL. Slide 88 gives a picture of the Clark Fork River, which was impaired by nutrients. There was too much green in the stream, as we say, too much algae. recognized as a problem for this water body, primarily impairing aesthetic and recreational uses for this water body. Slide 89 indicates how we needed to focus out, because there were multiple sources that needed to be addressed in this particular TMDL. Now, the actual area of being addressed by this TMDL was in the Montana portion of this watershed, and we needed to establish goals of nutrients in the Clark Fork River Basin, in this upper part of the Clark Fork River Basin, looking at all the point sources and non-point sources. But how clean is clean enough? That was our first challenge. As we see in slide 90, how much is an acceptable amount of gunk so that we can now declare victory and that we're clean enough? Well, our first step here in this TMDL, as we see in slide 91, is to establish a certain amount of nutrient goals. When we went to the state of Montana's water quality standards, there were not any numeric criteria or standards that were handed to this TMDL team to say, this is an acceptable amount of phosphorus, this is an acceptable amount of nitrogen, so that you meet your in-stream goals of cleanliness. There's a whole paper just on this topic of how the stakeholders got together and evaluated different methods to come up with ultimately numeric goals, measurable goals, that would be our expression of success within this a watershed. And on this slide 91, it indicates the acceptable amount of nitrogen and phosphorus within the Clark Fork, and also the amount of acceptable algae, benthic algae, in the substrate of the Clark Fork, in terms of milligrams per meter squared of chlorophyll A. Those were our measurable targets to judge success. Slide 92 is a fairly busy slide, a complex slide, but it indicates where we had to indicate throughout the watershed acceptable loads of load allocation, waste allocation, and TMDL. So we kind of portioned at critical points throughout the watershed what the acceptable loads were, kind of on a spatial basis. And from those points within the watershed, we could back into controls. In this case, controls on point sources were identified to meet the ambient water quality goals as determined in slide 91. Slide 93 then provides examples of a number of ways that water quality goals have been established, have been presented to EPA in terms of nutrient TMDLs, at least in our region. Gives example ways that water quality goals have been expressed, as well as TMDLs for nitrogen or phosphorus also. What we have to rely, or states have to rely on establishing these nutrient TMDLs, is their interpretation of narrative provisions within state standards. So you could say that the sediment goals that I've been talking about and the nutrient goals that I've been talking about are a way that states have expressed their water quality standards or their narrative portions of their water quality standards in a numeric sort of way. Let's go to slide 94, another opportunity for questions.
All right, Bruce, I'm going to go over a couple questions that have been submitted online. One is, how are watershed working groups part of the TMDL process?
There's various ways that watershed groups can be part of the TMDL process. As we saw, actually, on these last two case examples, the state relied heavily on the stakeholders to be part of just identifying the water quality goals of the receiving water. What are acceptable levels of sediment? What are acceptable levels of nutrients? So that can be, especially where a state has not dictated goals in terms of numeric criteria, and where, especially for nutrients, where it's a question of what is acceptable amount of green in the stream can be kind of an aesthetic kind of issue. Relying on stakeholders to help with that first process, but where a state already dictates, you know, kind of a numerical, that is kind of something that's already given to the TMDL process. But let's take a look at the next process in terms of establishing TMDLs, and that is determining monitoring to identify significant sources. So often, stakeholders, especially those that live and work within the watershed, kind of know the lay of the land already. They know where some of the significant sources may be. They can maybe participate in volunteer monitoring programs to support the state's effort to identify significant sources or to understand the cause and effect relationship of pollutant loadings and the effect in the stream, so they can participate in that sort of way. But now this next step, and that is to identify what is a good mix of allocation of responsibility within the watershed. This is almost a requirement we see in so many of our non-point source TMDLs that call upon some sort of change in how we manage land or how we manage a stream system. Have to rely on a stakeholder involvement within the watershed to let the state know what are some reasonable approaches to actually achieving our TMDL goals. And then lastly, not so much the TMDL development process, but implementing the TMDL relies so much on the watershed stakeholders to get the job done. If it doesn't involve, you know, the state prescribing, let's say, a waste allocation to a point source discharge, but even with that, when there's multiple point sources involved in a TMDL, so often what we see are states open that whole dialogue about, you know, who should be getting what piece of the TMDL pie, how should we allocate the responsibility within the watershed, is something that is part of the stakeholder process, even if it is involved with point sources.
Okay, great. Bruce, why don't you go ahead and move on to the next slide? We still have another question break later on.
Okay, great. Thank you. Slide 95 introduces us to a case example, and I just want to mention this briefly. It's a TMDL that was developed up in Montana for a pretty good quality water body. Swan Lake was seen as a threatened water body by the state of Montana, and they established a TMDL to protect the resource. In other words, what are the current pollutant loadings in this case for nutrients, for siltation? What are the current loadings and where are they coming from, and how can we maintain the current quality of Swan Lake? In some respects, land uses are being changed up there through development, through expansion of development. In other respects, timber harvest is on the decline in the Swan Lake watershed too. Looking at the multitude of land uses up there, how can the state of Montana put together a TMDL that will ensure that Swan Lake will maintain its high quality? If we go to slide 96, we'll see what I call a real boiled-down version of this TMDL. If you actually go to Montana DEQ website, you can download this TMDL and have an appreciation of the complexity of this TMDL from start to finish, because they have to deal with multiple sources, multiple pollutants. They have to express sediment, siltation targets when there are no numeric standards given to them in water quality standards. So they have to do some site-specific development of sediment targets as well as express TMDLs. And there's a lot more than what I have on this slide, but I just want to give you a little taste of the complexity of this TMDL that is, again, designed to protect a particular resources. And I think they've done a really good job working with EPA in developing this TMDL. It took several years to develop this TMDL, keeping involved the various stakeholders within this watershed. It wouldn't have been able, wouldn't have been possible without them. Staying with that same theme of stakeholder involvement, slide number 97, just reminds us of a real crucial element of TMDL, and that is public participation, stakeholder involvement. Slide 98 starts out with EPA's recommendation that the public should be involved from the very beginning of the process rather than being brought in at the end of the process. And some of these other bullets are part of EPA's recommendation of notification, solicitation of comments, letting EPA know what the state, what you as a state has, have done to engage the public in review of the TMDL so that when we review the TMDL, we're assured that public participation has occurred as part of the development of this TMDL process. We see that as one of those checklist items. Public has to be informed, and they have to have some opportunity to review the TMDL before we actually approve it. Slide 99 gets into this issue of variability. And this is somewhat tedious, and if you want to talk to me more about this, I can follow through. But I'm going to, for the sake of time, go through this fairly quickly. You might say, well, non-point sources, we go out there and observe non-point sources, and they're jumping all around the place. On wet days, we see high loads of sediment or nutrients or metals, whatever it might be. And on dry days, we may see no loadings of non-point sources. So how do you address this concept or this issue of variability in TMDLs? And there's three examples that I give out of the TMDLs that have been submitted to us in terms of how this might be addressed. I'd like everyone to jump to slide 102. Let's take a look at all three of these examples at the same time. How we've seen variability addressed in some of these TMDLs is through expressing the TMDL in terms of a long averaging period. Instead of saying acceptable pounds per day or acceptable pounds per year, it may be acceptable pounds per year over a long averaging period, over a certain number of years. So we'd really have to look at the watershed over a period of years to see whether this TMDL is being addressed or not. It could be, again, expressed in terms of pounds per day, but the averaging period associated with the TMDL may be a number of years. States have also used what we call the reference condition or reference year approach, where they observe what is happening from year to year, but they back calculate for that reference year what the load might be for that that reference year. You may not fully understand what I'm talking about here, but I'd be glad to follow up with you individually about this concept of baseline year to deal with variability. But sometimes, as we see in this last bullet, going back to Deep Creek sediment TMDL, the actual TMDL is expressed as a variability. It's not one number, but it's rather a number that varies with an important parameter, in this case, flow. So as flow changes, the acceptable amount of TMDL sediment coming into the stream also changes. So it's a function. It's a kind of a line on a graph, you might say, is the articulation of the TMDL. As we go to slide 103, we see what the current loading of sediment is based on total suspended solids here, milligrams per liter versus flow. If you go to slide 104, you'll see the goal line or the TMDL line, and that was defined by what we call a reference reach approach. Slide 105, again, reviews all three of these approaches to dealing with variability in non-point source TMDLs. Sorry you have to rush through this pretty quickly, but the fundamental behind all of these is that they must show, again, demonstrate how water quality standards are going to be met, no matter what approach they use in terms of articulating variability. Slide 106 gets into this topic of allocation, splitting up the TMDL pie. In our EPA guidance, especially for non-point sources, this talks about how a state might do this within the context of TMDL. To best illustrate these three bullets, I'm going to go on to slide 107 and talk about that first bullet. A state may allocate loads to different tributaries or sub-watershed areas, saying this sub-watershed we're going to try to maintain the load to this number of tons per year of sediment, let's say. This part of the sub-watershed gets a different allocation, and so it can be geographically allocated in terms of tons per year. Or the state may elect to, knowing the land use distribution within the watershed, allocate to the various land uses within the watershed rather than geographic areas, land use types. Slide 108 gives us yet another allocation method in EPA guidance, and that's the percent reduction method. Again, this can be done on a sub-watershed by sub-watershed basis, or it can be done on a land use by land use basis. So often we can do some level of modeling of land use contributions within a watershed, knowing what the current loading is by watershed, and actually determine what the percent reduction is on a land use by land use basis using modeling techniques. But slide 109 is what we call a performance-based allocation method. In slide 109, the performance-based allocation method actually lays out a map of the watershed and identifies where best management practices, or BMPs, may be installed to identify or address significant sources of the particular pollutant, in this case, let's say sediment, where certain BMPs, once they're applied within the watershed, will achieve RTMDL targets, however they may be expressed. But the common denominator, again, here, is that all of these allocation methods need to be linked back to and demonstrate how water quality standards are going to be achieved within the watershed. So we go to slide 110, which is another question slide.
All right, let me go ahead and take the phones off mute and allow the phone people to ask questions. Do we have any questions from the telephone for Bruce?
I had a question from your last set of slides. You had mentioned reasonable assurance as a component of the TMDL review criteria, and I was just wondering if you could provide an example of reasonable assurance.
Yes, where reasonable assurance shows up in EPA guidance is when there is both point source and non-point sources that need to be controlled. Now, as you can imagine, if we just pick on the point source, okay, we're going to put the full burden of meeting water quality standards on your shoulders. The point source may say, but look, if there's other non-point sources within the watershed that we can control to achieve water quality standards. Unfortunately, there is not very often a regulatory requirement that non-point sources be controlled. But if the TMDL is designed by the state, working with the stakeholders, saying, you know, we think we can control some of the non-point sources, and so often we can do that cheaper than the point source can, and distribute the burden of achieving water quality standards between point sources and non-point sources, one of the components in that TMDL has to be a reasonable assurance that those non-point source controls that the TMDL is relying on will indeed be implemented and be effective. Now, how can the state provide that reasonable assurance that those non-point sources that the point sources are relying on to kind of relax their burden of achieving water quality standards, how can we show that those are going to be done? Well, there's various ways that EPA said that a state can provide those reasonable assurance. They can show that there is money lined up to implement non-point source controls. There may be contracts that have been signed by landowners for non-point source BMP implementation. There's any number of ways that those reasonable assurances can be shown to EPA. But that's where reasonable assurance comes into the TMDL formula, is when we're going to rely on non-point source to lift the burden from point sources.
Yeah. Is there another question for the group, a group question for Bruce? Bruce, I have a question from the online people. Where do federal lands fit into the TMDL process? It seems to be primarily a state-based program.
Hopefully, if we're in a watershed where the federal government is managing the land, such as Park Service, Forest Service, Bureau of Land Management, BLM, they will be one of the stakeholders at the table to go through the whole TMDL development process. Sometimes we've seen instances where, let's say, the Forest Service manages 80-90% of the land within the watershed, and they'll step up to the plate and offer to the state that they construct the TMDL and hand that over to the state for them to
to establish, but they'll put a lot of the pieces together. So there's various roles we've observed federal land managers play in the TMDL development process, but as a minimum, we hope that they're one of the stakeholders at the table.
Is there another question from the telephone audience for Bruce?
I have a question.
Okay.
You had mentioned, I think, earlier in the presentation that there is no implementation plan required by the state to submit to the EPA.
Right.
Is there any further enforcement beyond establishing the TMDL for final cleanup or monitoring of the water body or monitoring whether it has been cleaned up to the standards that were proposed?
Really isn't when it comes to non-point sources. Whereas the TMDL plan relies on non-point source controls to get the job done, there really isn't a tool or some regulation that can be used to follow up to make sure that the job is done. But if there's point sources that are ascribed to waste location within TMDL, yes, there is. There is a regulatory approach that is used, and that's the state, usually the state, or if EPA still has the primacy in the state, NPDES permitting program. And there's a requirement in the NPDES permitting reg saying that if there's an EPA-approved TMDL that has a waste location component in it for this particular permittee, that permit has to be issued with that waste load allocation. So there is a way to ensure that the TMDL is actually implemented when we're talking sources. When we're talking non-point sources, very little, at least under the auspices of the Clean Water Act.
All right, I'm going to go ahead and mute the group, and you can finish up, Bruce.
Can I? Okay, slide 111. And you're saying, Bruce, what are you doing here? In 1948, a photographer by the name of Philip Halsman took this photograph of artist Salvador Dali. And this is before the day of multiple imaging and Photoshop and that sort of thing. It took 5 hours to actually take this photograph, 26 attempts, and as you can imagine, it took a lot of teamwork. At the count of three, the photographer asked all the folks that were in the room to do their part, whether it was holding up the chair or throwing the buckets of water, in this case also kind of tossing the cats up in the air, and Salvador Dali himself had to jump. To get this photograph, it took strong, intense teamwork. And that's kind of a theme here I'd like to leave with you today for the TMDL process, is that it takes teamwork to get the TMDL job done. Various components of this whole watershed process that need to be brought to bear to end up with successful TMDLs. Slide 112 indicates one of those really crucial parts of the TMDL formula, and that is monitoring. Slide 113 gives another picture of in-stream monitoring. Monitoring, you could say, is really kind of a backbone of getting the job done in all facets of the TMDL program. Slide 114 gives us a little bit more description of that. Monitoring plays a role in terms of identifying our criteria, identifying how far we are from achieving those standards. It helps us identify significant sources under the TMDL column. It also helps us document effectiveness of the TMDL, post-TMDL implementation. So monitoring is one of those team programs that have to be part of the whole TMDL process. But slide 115 gives a whole bunch of other processes that can be part of the TMDL team, whether it is the Waterquality Standards Program, the Wetlands Program of the state. There are certain non-water, Clean Water Act programs also on this page that we see that are fairly important in certain watersheds, the Superfund CERCLA program, and as I mentioned before, federal land management programs can also play an important role in developing successful TMDLs. Why, you might ask, in slide 116, will Bruce always have a job? Why will we always need TMDLers out there? Slide 116 explains a little bit of that. In states and tribes, there's always this updating of water quality standards. And as the targets have changed, as the water quality standards are updated and they become changed, then we need to go back and maybe change TMDLs or establish TMDLs for pollutants for which we never had numeric criteria before. Environmental conditions are changing through the years, too, which may require us to also update or revise TMDLs. There's shifting priorities that are imposed upon us. There are new water quality programs that are uncovered as we go through time that call upon the TMDL team to come forward and address those new water quality problems. Some of our assumptions that we used in previous TMDLs need to be revisited, too, which may call upon us to perhaps revise TMDLs. If you don't already have a job in the TMDL team, get a job in the TMDL team, because I think this work will always be before us. So, slide 117. Let's just don't sit there. Let's go forward and really see how the TMDLs can improve our life. I've got here my telephone number and my email. I recommend to people that if they could, give me a call, because I respond best to phone messages than email, because I get quite a few every day. That's my presentation today. Thank you so much for being a very attentive audience, and I think we do still have some time for questions, Susan.
Yeah, we'll go to the questions in a moment, and I do recognize that we have online questions and phone questions that everyone hasn't gotten a chance to ask and won't get a chance to ask. But one thing I want to do first, Bruce, is draw everyone's attention to the links to additional resources. If you're on the slide presentation, you click on the little home icon at the top. It brings you back to the homepage, which does have Bruce's address and phone number. And at the bottom, I want to draw your attention to two things. One is the links to additional resources, and the other is the seminar feedback form. I'd like to remind everyone to please fill out the seminar feedback form today. And on the links to additional resources, we have links to today's presentation, if you haven't already downloaded, EPA's TMDL website, which is at www.epa.gov/ol/TMDL, a link to America's Clean Water Foundation and the Association of State and Interstate Water Pollution Control Administrators, their website on TMDLs. We have the EPA Water Quality Standards website, Section 319 Success Stories. We have a Watershed Modeling online training course. We have a Clean Water Act online training course. So there are several other resources available to folks, and I'd like to draw your attention to those. And now we do have just a few moments for additional questions on the phone. Let me open the phone lines up. Do we have specific questions for Bruce in the last few minutes?
Yes, I have a question about reasonable assurance. Suppose I have good BMP.
Yeah, I will.
And how do I quantify the reduction in the load? Does the state quantify that, or EPA quantify that, or I need to quantify that?
So,
Johnny. Jennifer.
I'm sorry, if I could just make everyone aware that everyone is now off mute, so if you could please let Bruce answer the questions. Thank you.
The question has to do with who quantifies the reduction in loads that might come from implementing a TMDL. Whose responsibility is that? There's a fundamental responsibility on the part of states to monitor their water through the years, to gauge the health of their waters, to see where waters are being improved through the years, and that includes watersheds where TMDLs have been implemented. They don't always have the resources that they need to do. Very often do they not have the resources to do a thorough job of that, but there's a fundamental responsibility on the part of states. Now, again, they can rely on federal partners, local partners, volunteers to get some of that job done. But sometimes the TMDL will articulate a load reduction that is not always measurable. So you'll see in today's presentation that there may be some surrogates that we use to judge success of a particular TMDL, and it may not be measuring actual load reductions. It may be measuring, let's say, the fish populations. It may be measuring a channel health in terms of the amount of sediment, let's say, within a channel. So there may be some of these surrogate measures that are laid out in the TMDL as a surrogate of health for that water body and is not a direct measure of load allocation. But to get to your fundamental question about whose responsibility it is, it's responsibility on the part of the state to sponsor a monitoring program on the health of their waters.
Okay, excellent. Yes?
Actually, I wanted to find out how do I quantify for reasonable assurances. Suppose I have good BMPs and I'm saying that it is going to work to reduce the load. So the state will determine that?
Well, first of all, EPA would approve the TMDL with confidence that there's enough reasonable assurance. And that's kind of the, we would approve that TMDL, the water body would come off the list. Now it would again be incumbent upon the state to follow through with that. Now, the state does have certain authorities often in their state law to require the permittee to do some monitoring also. And so we see some instances of them exercising that authority where they'll prescribe a requirement in the permit to do ambient monitoring to make sure that the non-point sources are achieving their goal.
Thank you.
Excellent. Bruce, I'd like to thank you very much today for your participation and your excellent presentation and answering all the questions. I think we've had a very interesting session and look forward to working with you again in the future.
Thank you so much for the help, Susan.
All right. Thank you, everyone. That ends our webcast for today.